During the mid-90s, a cultural revolution hit Britain, which had the power to shake the very foundations of popular culture. Suddenly, teenagers were awakening from the social depression of the 80s to find a brand new sound of soft rock. For 5 years in the 90s, Britpop ruled the world and created melancholic music which defined a generation. In this series, to celebrate 30 years of Britpop, Josh and the team speak to some of the key players who were pivotal to the most potent musical movement since the Beatles and ask what made this period so culturally significant. So don't look back in anger, girls and boys, let's go for gold as we remember the cultural phenomenon that was Britpop.
Frontman of English rock band Reef, singer-songwriter Gary Stringer formed the English rock group in 1993 alongside Amy Newton on guitar, Jack Besson on bass and Luke Bullen on drums. Their 1994 debut single Good Feeling paved the way for Naked, which was used in a TV advert for the Sony Minidisc. But it was their 1997 album Glow which catapulted Reef into the Britpop elite and spawned the 90s anthem Place Your Hands. As part of Beyond the Title's Britpop season, I caught up with the evergreen soft rock icon to talk heroes, eras, and his recollections on one of the most defining musical revolutions in history. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Gary Stringer.
So Gary, welcome to this special podcast celebrating the Britpop revolution. By way of an introduction, looking back on the period, what was Reef's contribution to the wider musical landscape of the 90s? And how did you fit into that great culture of the time?
Wow, there's an opening gambit. I don't know. It's always hard to see yourself in context of the time, especially when you're young. Everything was very tribal then. Seems to have got a lot friendlier, music. But it was tribal. It kind of felt like us against the world. As far as Britpop goes, I wasn't too keen on wrapping, you know, myself up in the Union flag. I got no problem with it, with England, with Scotland, you know, Wales, whatever. But I don't know. I've always felt music was of no nation, had no flag. So that whole thing, I mean, on our second album, Glow, you know, on Don't You Like It, I mention I'm not bothered about representing the nation. You know, I sing that in the lyric. It meant very little to me personally. I had no problem with it. Good luck to everyone involved. But for me, I was just singing in a rock and roll band and, you know, we'd taken influences from all over, you know, whether it's AC/DC or, you know, soul music from America, great guitar bands, you know, like the Stones, the Beatles, the Who. I remember, you know, when Nirvana came around, you know, it changed everything. You know, we'd come out of the 80s and into the early 90s. And that was really exciting for me, that American sound. I liked Rage Against the Machine. So Britpop as a cultural phenomenon was incredible. It meant so much to so many people. And, you know, I've got no problem with that, but it wasn't something that I wanted to use in my favor in any way, although I'm sure, especially in America and Australia, it opened doors because, as you know, gents know, as journalists, movements within music carry extra weight and, you know, get people listening to lots of different sorts of music. But yeah, I hope that answers your question.
Good, yeah.
Josh said it goes nicely into the next question, as if you knew the next question. So, of course, the Britpop era immediately succeeded the era of grunge, and in April 94, you know, saw the event which one of the most defining moments of the decade when Kurt Cobain committed suicide. How do you think this inspired bands like Reef to create British versions of grunge? And looking back now, how different was this style of music from the guitar sound of Britpop?
Wow. I think the good thing about grunge, no matter what sort of band you were in, whether it's pop, rock, whatever, in the UK, was it got guitar bands onto the radio and onto the television. So you can be thankful to the grunge movement for that. It kind of suited our lifestyle because we were, you know, Southwest and we'd grown up surfing and Jack was really into skateboarding and, you know, rock music. So it fitted for us, that style. We didn't have to adjust any part of our dress to fit with that. And I think maybe when Britpop came along, we didn't quite fit because we had that look anyway. That was our natural style. But I think that grunge certainly opened up the radio waves and the television. You could play a lot more on the television then as a band than you can maybe now. It's maybe only later with Jules Holland that's left, right? But that's certainly got guitar bands in through the door. And then, like I said earlier, with the cultural movement, which was spectacular, you know, it was spectacular to see so much creativity. You know, Pulp, I thought, were incredible. Blur, fantastic. You know, what Oasis did, you know, you take your hat off to them. You know, they were like a firestorm, man. They just, you know, just took everything in front of them and chewed it all up. But it was an exciting time. But maybe with my last answer as well, when you're involved in it, you know, when it's you and your life, I mean, I was in my early 20s, you know, you're just living and thinking about performing and, you know, doing all sorts of daft things that, you know, young humans do in rock bands. But, I guess grunge did fade away and in came Britpop. And it was exciting. It was fabulous to be around and to be playing through those times. And it's definitely left a musical legacy, which is really special.
Josh has asked, what was the most mental thing you've ever done?
Well, I must say, Josh, your questions are bang on. They're really interesting. What is the most mental thing I've ever done? Well, I don't think I would here, but one of the things on your last question, I seem to be dipping back into each question as I go, but one of the big things that was mental at the time, we all lived in a house in Isleworth, West London or Middlesex, when we started. And within 6 months, we got signed. And we in the old days, you know, you made a demo tape, so an old audio cassette, and you sent it out and you took some photos of the band and, you know, tried to get management and record company deals. And one of the crazy things at the start of that is that Paul Weller heard our 7-inch that we were selling at shows, and he really liked the B-side, Choose to Live. So we went from playing to 100 people in pub back rooms in our beat up Volkswagen van, you know, to playing the Albert Hall and, you know, Aston Villa Leisure Centre and, you know, 5 or 6 shows on his Wildwood tour. So that was pretty mental. That whole period, you know, I mean, we got asked to support the Stones at Brixton Academy. That was crazy seeing, you know, the guy who signed us, Muff Winwood, was the head of our label. We were on Sony Square. He got a phone call from Mick Jagger saying, oh, I love your band. Can they come and support us at the Brixton Academy? And we did, and we went on down. And I remember doing our sound check and seeing, I think it was Keith Richards walking the big double doors at the back of the auditorium with this cartoon melee of journalists with cameras and boom mics. And it was just like a cartoon, you know, when you have a cartoon fight, all the energy, hands and cameras poking out. So there was it was a mental time. But to go out with Paul Weller, it's something I won't ever forget. We owe him so much. I mean, he was just into the band and, you know, he'd watch sound checks and watch the shows. And he looked after us so well. It's actually incredible. And we've supported loads of bands since. And still to this day, the best we've ever been treated was on tour with Paul Weller. So, yeah, it was a mental time, full stop, Josh.
So April 1994 was a busy month for music. Obviously, the tragic death of Cobain, but it was also the very month that Stuart McConey first coined the word Britpop. In your opinion, how did these two separate events come to pave the way for the music revolution that followed? And how did this influence Britpop's transatlantic appeal? And did they really care about breaking America?
Well, breaking America is no mean feat, and hats off to any of the British bands who've done it. We went out and toured in America. I think we had a buzz clip on MTV for a while, and we were selling a couple of thousand copies a week of our album. And I think we did about 6 or 9 months. You know, it is like, you know, the continent of Europe with every country being a state. It's a big old place and you can get lost there. And I think, you know, we came home to make another record. And I guess you'd have had to have stayed there for another year to break America. But yeah, Kurt Cobain died. That was horrible, wasn't it? It was vile, but you could see he wasn't a very happy man in his head, maybe, or, you know, he didn't sit easy with himself. I don't know what it was. Incredibly talented songwriter and performer, and what a great band. And you've seen what, you know, Dave Grohl's gone on and done with his career. And that was incredibly sad. But again, like I said earlier, you know, without the grunge thing, you know, the guitar bands wouldn't have found it so easy to get onto the radio and the television. So that really helped. But I think for Britpop broadly, it was great. You know, I mean, I'm a rock and roll singer, and I guess, you know, I did an interview the other week, and, you know, I can mimic, you know, voices and accents. I suppose for me, it was more of being able to sing well. And a lot of my heroes, you know, were American or Australian. I wanted to be able to sing well. And it was great to hear people singing in their own accents, having that cultural identity. And I think that meant a lot to a lot of people. And I think that's one of the positive things that came out of Britpop.
Just said you've done it again with the next question.
I know.
So
it was that first question that I have another question to refer back to.
Reformed in 1993, before the word Britpop had been attributed to boys with guitars. But it was the same year as the notorious revolution at Radio One. In your opinion, how did Matthew Bannister's controversial shake-up enhance your opportunities to get national airplay?
Well, certainly on our second record, I mean, Radio One played us on our first record, no doubt about it. With Naked, you know, that was a big hit. I don't know whether you know about the Sony Minidisc advert. When we got signed up, Sony wanted to use our song on this new format, this mini disc, which is basically like a small CD, a recordable small CD. We went out and did it. We had a ball, you know, flying out to America. A couple of us had never been on planes before, you know, picked up in a limo, models in the hotel foyer. It was bonkers and really exciting. But we didn't want to release that song first. We thought if we released that song first, it would kill us. It would kill us dead. And, you know, we released Good Feeling, which charted in the 20, I think, or top 30 certainly, and then released Naked. And that certainly got a lot of Radio 1 airplay, and that would have been post 1993 with the shakeup you're talking about. I don't know too much about that, but I do know, you know, certainly Chris Evans played Place Your Hands loads, and that really was a big deal for us. You know, you could tell his enthusiasm for the song, and it helped, you know, cement that song into people's minds, the melody, the lyric, the rhythm. And yeah, I don't know much what to say. All that stuff with the radio, I mean, it's a bit of a racket, isn't it? You know, you pay a radio plugger to go into these stations back then, and they offer up these songs, you know, to these producers, and maybe one sticks. And we were lucky; we did get plenty of radio play. So whatever went on there, I was happy with the outcome, because it meant we got played. You know, the first album went top 10, and the second album went to number one, and you know, we were flying. But I tried not to get involved in all that stuff. You know, behind the curtain, I just wanted to sing, you know, and get drunk and hang out with my friends. So, yeah, it worked out for us, whatever he did.
Debut singles are always hard. Sorry, debut singles are always a difficult thing to gauge. And back in the 90s, record labels had autonomy over pretty much everything. In hindsight, what would you have done differently in order to protect your creative freedom?
Nothing, because like I just said, we already did that. You know, I think if we'd have released Naked as our first single instead of Good Feeling, I think we could have had a number one single, because it'd been all over the telly. But if you remember that band Stiltskin, they had one song, it was on a Levi's ad, and it went in at number one, and they were gone, they were dead. And we'd seen that happen, and we didn't want it to happen to us. We wanted to have a future, so we made sure. And you know, our label was great. You know, Muff Winwood, Lincoln Elias, you know, they understood music, and they let us do, you know, our own thing and express ourselves. They had an input, and I would always listen to their input. But at the end of the day, if you're not happy with the music or the choice of songs, you ain't going to have your heart in it. And it felt like we were listened to, and hopefully it felt like we were listening to them as well. You know, people who've been in the industry a lot longer than us, you know, 19 or 20 or 21 or whatever, you know, when we signed. So yeah, creatively, I always want to be in charge of, you know, the output, the way that, you know, Paul Cohen came out with us on shows, and he did a lot of photographs of the first couple of tours we did, the Wildwood tour. I said with Paul Weller, he came out, and I think that the single, Good Feeling, the cover of that is a shot of me playing at the Albert Hall. And I mean, his artwork and photography was second to none. It was, we were really lucky to find him, and really lucky that he wanted to get involved with us. Now, I know he had some spats with the label about exactly how he wanted it to come across. But he fought his corner, and we would have backed him and listened to all opinions. And I don't feel like we compromised on anything, genuinely. It was exciting. I was into it, you know, but someone like Muff Winwood, you know, he's had more hit singles than you've had hot dinners. And if you turned up into the label and said you're retired because you've been touring, you know, he'd been up and down the A1 in the Dorma van doing two shows a day, you know, in the 60s. So you got kind of listened to him. You had respect for him. But yeah, I can honestly say, hand on heart looking back now, I don't think there's anything I would have changed, just because it felt as in control as a crazy whirlwind can. But, you know, as far as the music and the way we looked and were presented, I felt all right with it.
Josh said, how do you think Paul Weller helped the Britpop scene?
Yeah, he's massive. He's like the godfather. Still is. I mean, the songs that guy's written, His approach to performance is inspirational now. You know, I see he's going out to Japan and he's been through Europe now. He works hard, he plays hard, and he's all about the music. You know, that impressed me at a young age and it still impresses me now. Yeah, he's the godfather of Britpop, no doubt about it. And he's a don. And any of your viewers who are listening, watching, you know, he's an absolute gentleman as well. He's a golden human and a very talented man.
So in your opinion, was the creative battle a contributing factor to why Britpop became so potent?
Yeah, it's definitely that tribal element, guys. Definitely a tribal element. I mean, when we walked onto a stage, a festival, and we didn't sell as many records, you know, as Blur or Oasis, but we knew we could hold our own. You know, we had a great drummer, Dominic Greensmith, fabulous, percussive, rhythmic drummer, great feel. Ken Wynn House, the guitar player. I think he's one of the top 10 guitar players the country's ever produced. I know a lot of your listeners will roll their eyes and tusk at the screen at this point, but he got such a great sound. He had such a good feel and he could play anything. I mean, we'd be thrown, you know, covers as we do covers on the telly. We'd learn them in a couple of days and go and play them. And it was exciting. You know, Jack's rhythm and performance, you know, I'm still playing with Jack today. And I can say in the 30 odd years we've been playing together, there's never an evening where he turns up to the show, to the stage and doesn't put more than 100% into the performance. And he works hard. He's a talented, talented songwriter and bass player. So we never felt scared. Doesn't matter who we were up against, who was on after us, who was on before us. I mean, I wouldn't have been wanted to go on after us, but everyone had their own flavor. But yeah, it was tribal. You said hello to people, but you know, you wanted to be the winners. You felt like a gang, or Reef certainly did. We felt like a gang. You know, you're going out there and you're just trying to grab as much of the attention and the energy from the crowd as you can, throw it back at them. And it made for some fabulous gigs, you know, and then you go and get smashed up. Yeah, wicked time. Good fun.
Going back to your 94 hit with Naked that was used in that TV advert for Sony Minidisc, how did this affect your reputation in the industry? And do you think this was a sign that the industry was feeling the phenomenon of Britpop?
Well, I mean, don't forget that video was shot in New York. So it looked American, you know, and we were a rock and roll band, maybe not so fervently Britpoppy as everyone else. You know, we were headbangers, really. But we always wanted to have a groove, always had to have a groove, you know, like the Stones with, you know, the great music they made. You know, I want to make the girls dance. I want to make the boys dance. I want to make everyone smile. I want to make everyone, you know, enjoy themselves as best I can as a performer, as an artist. But we, you know, like I said earlier, we didn't release that song first. And I think, you know, that could have caused us problems. We got a lot of stick off the Inky Press at the time for doing it. You know, Sounds and Melody Maker give us a hard time about it. You know, it was seen from their point of view as if we'd sold out by doing a TV advert, but it got our song into people's front rooms. And I think nowadays, the culture's changed so much that I think any artist from, you know, Beyonce to whoever would kill to get a TV advert for their music because, you know, obviously the internet has widened everything out a lot, but to actually get into people's homes with music, with performance or sound, it's not easy, you know. Like I said, apart from Jules Holland, there ain't really much in the way of TV shows that let you perform. So it's a great way of sharing your music, showing people and letting people hear you. But yeah, we had a bit of stick for it. So fucking what? It didn't bother me one jot at the time. It doesn't bother me now. And we, like I say, we didn't release it first. Hopefully that gave us a bit of longevity.
Yeah.
Almost every band struggles with the strange relationship with their biggest hits. But in 1997, Reef released the album Glow, which obviously featured the anthem Place Your Hands. What were your first impressions of the song, and how do you think it was able to identify perfectly with a certain moment in time?
Well, I have told this story before, but the first time I realised that Place Your Hands was special, Muff Winwood turned up to the recording of it. We'd started Glow. We'd done a West Coast tour of America, a few shows. We'd come back, and we started work with a different producer. Clive Martin did the first record, fabulous producer and engineer. And we'd met George Draculius when we went out to the West Coast of America to work. And he came over to London to Abbey Road, and we started work on the second album. And I think we recorded two or three or four songs there that I had to sing on them again. But George really didn't like Abbey Road, I don't think. I don't know why, but, it was all the white coats and you work between these hours. And, he said, guys, come back to Los Angeles and we'll finish this record. And, if he wants to get the drums tuned at 4 a.m., he can, or order food. It was his environment. But, to see Muff turn up at the studio, it was the first time with Place Your Hands that I clicked something was different. He hadn't come to the studio before, apart from maybe to listen back to bits. But actually, as we recorded that song, he was there in the room. So that made me think, especially in hindsight, this guy knows songs, and he's clocked that this song could maybe be a hit record. And he didn't come out to see another one until I've Got Something to Say on the next record. So it kind of, in hindsight, that made me think, because to us, they were all of our songs were your babies. You've got 10 or 12 songs for the next record. And sure, you start to think, maybe this could be a single or not. But to see him come out, that was the first time I thought, this could be a hit. And then the traction it got was incredible. I said earlier, Chris Evans played it loads, Radio 1, Virgin, all sorts of stations jumped on it. And it became a really, really big hit. And it's still the song today people know most, recognize as being Reef most. And I'm really proud of it. I love it. There were stories going around that, we didn't like the TFI thing. Bollocks as far as, well, just speaking personally, I was totally cool with it. Every band that, went in and did TFI Friday was asked to do a jingle of their song they were, releasing, whether it was the Foo Fighters or Oasis, whoever it was, everyone did it. And that song for us with It's Your Letters stuck. But it never bothered me. Never bothered me at all. And rumors were going around that it did, but it helped get the melody across. And I couldn't be prouder of that song. It's I wish I had 10 like them. It's still selling 1,000 copies a week, and I'm really proud of it.
Josh said it's his favourite karaoke song.
Yes, Josh.
Well, we'll try recording him doing it one day and send it to you.
Dude, get it up on the socials. I want to see.
So obviously the song was adapted for TFI Friday for the feature It's Your Letters. In hindsight, how do you think Chris Evans and TFI Friday were able to perfectly capture the free-flowing mood and energy of the time? And what kind of effect did this have on Reef's longevity?
Again, it puts you on people's TV, TFI was, I'm going to watch it before I go out dancing to the pub, whatever, go out for my night out, my Friday night. It was a perfect idea for a television show. I mean, Chris is a genius. He's a very, very clever man. His attention to detail and his enthusiasm is second to none. He really is very, very talented, I think. But that show was a big crazy party, and I was just glad to be invited. You know, it was bonkers from the moment you got there to the time you know, middle of the morning when you left. Really good fun. Great to have live bands. Great that it was shot live. Anything could happen. It's exciting. You know, when you've got one take to do something and it's going out live, you know, that gives you a great buzz. But yeah, the show was really representative of the time, wasn't it? You know, it was crazy and fast and exciting and full of love and booze and all sorts. It was cool.
Yeah, Josh said it's one of his favourite shows ever.
Mm. Amen.
No.
Yeah, Josh said, because no other show has that freedom.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what makes it so exciting and the energy, because it's live. It's going out live and something crazy happens and, you know, people run with it or they lose the plot. I mean, but it definitely, it was like a big bottle of champagne going off every Friday. It was bubbly and exciting and, yeah, I loved it. And all the new music was on there, you know, all the new music that was coming out was going on there. And it was great fun to be a part of. Yeah, it was cool, Josh. Really enjoyed it.
Josh said, what did you think of the remake?
Well, we were on that as well. We got asked to do that as well. And, you know, we obviously said yes straight away. We were, you know, happy to do it. But I haven't actually watched it back, which makes me sound like a football manager and not seeing a tackle, right? But it never went forward. But, yeah, I still enjoyed it. There was a moment just before we went on to be interviewed. We were in a corridor backstage at wherever the new one was shot. And when the music came on, or I don't know, maybe it was the Ocean Colour Scene song. Anyway, one of the tunes was playing. And we were in this dark corridor and with this woman with a clipboard. And I suddenly was transported back to 1990, whatever, and doing that show. But yeah, good fun, man. Good fun. I remember one time we went in to perform Consideration. And we had a show in Denmark that night. And I remember we had to go to like Northolt, somewhere like that, and get on a private plane. And it took us to the show, but out the window you could see like one of those comets that was coming over it. So just really special memories, man. But yeah, the remake was the remake. I don't know what to say to you, but yeah, I think he's a clever man and it was a wonderful show.
Josh said he thinks they should bring it back.
There you go, Josh. Yeah, let's do it. I'm in.
So what sort of dealings did you have with other bands of the time?
Well, bits and bobs, not loads. We didn't hang out loads with other bands. I probably hang out more with musicians now because you were just working. You were busy. And it was definitely that tribal thing, you know, you kind of kept yourself to yourself and everyone was posing and trying to be too cool for school. And, you know, we were four guys from the West Country just doing our own thing. So, you know, we were never rude to anyone unless, you know, they'd said something nasty about us and then we might have thumped them. But that aside, you know, we just kind of kept, we had our own groove. We had our own thing. We knew we could perform. We weren't scared of anyone. We were happy to go and play at any show, supporting anyone on anywhere on the bill. We knew we could do it. But, yeah, as far as hanging out with bands, no, not really. I don't know whether I should say this, but anyway, I'm not going to say that. I was just thinking, yeah, a little bit, maybe. Yeah, nothing.
Josh is telling you to say it.
No, I'm not, because I don't know.
Get himself in trouble.
It was really good fun, and definitely, you know, I can remember having a, you know, a couple of parties here and there with people, and you know, by that, you know, by the time after the show, you're so far gone anyway. I'd be buggered if I remembered half the people I hung out with, but yeah, it was.
So, was it difficult not to indulge in the rock and roll lifestyle back then?
Say the question again.
Was it difficult not to indulge in the rock and roll lifestyle?
Well, I did indulge.
Yeah, it was it difficult not to?
Yeah, no, not it wasn't difficult, and none of it was difficult. It was, I mean, now, you know, I love singing, and I love singing more than anything. I love singing more than altering my bodily space. But at the time, you know, yeah, you were doing all sorts of daft stuff, and it was just what it was, you know. Young people going out and happened to be in a band, partying, enjoying ourselves. But yeah, no, it was what it was. And like now, I won't drink, you know, when I sing. I think I'm better for it. You know, but back then, all bets were off. It was bonkers. I remember when I stopped drinking on gig days, we were in America and maybe somewhere near San Francisco or something like that, and gone somewhere else. I remember waking up in the gutter with a bum and thinking, what are you doing? And then I had some shows in Sweden or somewhere as well when I was – anyway, I don't know where or when, but I remember like the next day when you throw up, when you've gone too crazy – that happening at like midday and then 2 o'clock and then mid-afternoon. And I remember vomiting once before going on a show, wherever it was, just before I went on. And that made me think, oh, you got to stop this, man. You got to fucking stop boozing it up. And I did. I was able to. But even now, you know, you go and do a show, and if you walk around, you know, the auditorium with a cup of tea or a glass of water or a Coke, everyone's saying, oh, you're not drinking. Oh, you're not drinking. I said, no, but I'm fucking alive. And I'm happy with that. You know, I'm happy that it's all gone. I'm happy to be still breathing.
Josh said, when you mean Coke, you meant the drink.
Yeah, Josh. You're a troublemaker, you are. Yours is going to get you in all sorts of trouble.
Oh dear. Did you ever feel like an onlooker of the Britpop scene?
No, not ever. No. It was, you know, my young life from 20 to 30, whatever it was. You know, we had a blinded time. We took a rest in 2004, maybe. So, yeah, I've done a decade straight of going around the world, having a whole lot of fun. I never felt like an onlooker. It was bits of it that you loved, bits of it that you didn't like so much. But, you know, on the whole, it's just incredible decade, really good fun. And now I'm sounding nostalgic, so I'm going to stop talking about it.
So what are your memories of appearing on Top of the Pops?
Oh, that was funny. Yeah. You'd made it with your parents and extended family when you got on Top of the Pops, because it was such a institution, you know, thing that had been around all your life, that had been around all their life. You know, all your family had seen their heroes perform on Top of the Pops. And I reckon we'd done it three or four times, maybe five, I don't know, quite a few times. And by the end, they tried to like get you to play live and all that, and I remember they made me sing on one of them, but the band were miming. So it was fucking bonkers, wasn't it? But it was good fun. I remember Dom and Ken stole the EastEnders milk float and drove that around the BBC compound one time, and yeah. I enjoyed the bar afterwards. But it was just a little promotion thing, wasn't it? You go in and toss your hair around and you know, in front of the camera. But yeah, I thought that's what it was, and that's what it, you know, maybe should have stayed. I don't know, but yeah, I don't know why they got rid of it, really. Something that's been going so long, but anyway, they did, and that's in the past now. So yeah, it was a good laugh. Good laugh. I mean, I think from a performance point of view, it was always better going on Jules. The way that they did that with performing in the round, so everyone's watching everyone. That the musician, you know, that was, you know, really good fun. But Top of the Pops, it's iconic. You know, it was again, it was where, you know, all your friends and family, you've made it. You know, if they weren't into music, you know, maybe they hear on Radio One, or maybe they see on Top of the Pops, suddenly the penny drops. Yeah, we're actually doing something. Yeah, fun show.
If you had to pinpoint a specific moment that defined Britpop, what would it be?
You'd probably say either the song Common People by Pulp. Absolutely fucking brilliant song. Great lyric, great song, great songwriting. Or I guess, you know, the Blur Oasis Battle. But yeah, I don't know, one of those two, I guess.
Josh said, did you ever get involved in a battle, and were you Team Oasis or Team Blur?
No, apart from your egos having battles all the time, we did a battle on the football pitch. We won the 1996 Soccer Cup. You know, our band had always played football. And, you know, our crew used to, you know, you'd be on a bus and you'd be going through Europe or America. And one of the things you could do, apart from drink yourself daft on a day off, would be, you know, play football. And we always did it. So, yeah, I think we Oasis and Blur miraculously got to play each other in one of the games. Pretty fun, but that was the only kind of battling we did. I think we beat Apollo 440 in the final 1-0. And I had my kind of cruciate injury in one of those tournaments. Jim Arakoi's manager tackled me from behind, but he probably, I looked like a right prat because I was wearing those sort of tiny 70s shorts, you know. Shorts, but yeah, that wasn't very nice. I remember hearing my cruciate pop, so that was pretty battly. But yeah, good fun. Yeah, that was the battling we'd done on the football field.
What would you say the legacy of Britpop is?
It's a time that people are already now, like you guys, you know, looking back on, and people, you know, in their 40s or 50s who lived through it will remember fondly because it's your youth, you know, and that's just the way it works. But I guess to have that movement and to have that cultural tag is really cool. You know, it helps, you know, people making radio shows and podcasts and whatnot, doesn't it? It's a thing that works for people to explore within. Yeah, some great music. Certainly for me, some great times. I loved it. Loved it to bits.
And looking back at your career, what was your proudest achievement?
Number one record is pretty good. You know, I remember we had a midweek of one. And I don't know when the chart came out then, Sunday. So I think Saturday night or something, we would get. I said to my manager at the time, Hank, I said, give me a phone. And just tell me the number. Don't say hello, how are you? Just give me a number. And when I picked up the phone and he said one, yeah, I was stoked. I thought, well, no matter what we do, they can't take that away from us. You know, I know we'd done 100,000 copies of that record in 1 week. And for us, that was a really big deal, you know, to get a gold record on week one and have a number one was, you know, really exciting. So, yeah, that'd be my answer.
Josh said, did you ever get the framed copy that they give out on TV?
Did I ever get what?
The framed copy.
Framed? Oh, yeah, yeah. I got a couple in the loft. I know we got a gold record in Australia, and the size of it was massive. I thought, that's got to go in the loft or in the bin or something. Yeah, I got a couple. Got any up in the house. Got a couple.
And what's next for Gary Stringer?
Well, we've done our last Reef show this year on the bank holiday August weekend. So we've just come off the back of releasing a record about 2 years ago now called Shoot Me Your Ace. And, you know, that charted top 20, which was great for us. And we've just done 2 years of tour and we've, you know, a couple of shows in Europe, been around the UK a couple of times, all the main cities. Last year we did, or earlier this year, we did some provincial shows through April and May, and then we've just done a stack load of festivals, and yeah, we'll go away and see what happens next. But I've got a few solo shows I'm going to do until Christmas with my acoustic guitar that, you know, I can barely play, but it's good fun. I went and done one the other week, and it's amazing that, you know, people want to come out and see you, and I quite enjoy learning new things, so that's been good fun. That I've got 4 or 5 of them until Christmas, not loads. And then I reckon I'll be looking to record some music next year. So, yeah, we'll see.
Josh said, where are the shows?
Oh, they're only in small places. It's where people have offered me them. I did Portsmouth the other week. I've got Swansea, December the 15th is the last show. I'm going to Nottingham. Yeah, and yeah, just places around where people have reached out on the internet and said, will you come and play? And I thought, well, it's, you know, why not? What else am I going to do? Keeps me at the pub, doesn't it, Josh?
Thank you very much to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title episode. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? We're now on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews. And if you love Josh, please give us a little share. And we don't mean the Shoop Shoop song. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.